This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi, I'm Sharad Kutin, and welcome to the show that walks you through some fundamental concepts in the social sciences and humanities. Together with Amat Fuad Rahmat, the show tries to reveal how various thinkers have grappled with theories and concepts the better to understand how society works. Each week, we will discuss a classic text or a concept that we hope will shed light on the world around you. This week, it's the public sphere. And to help us think through this issue is Tessa Houghton, Assistant Professor in Media and Communications at Nottingham University, Malaysia.
Welcome, Tessa.
Thank you so much for being here. So you're talking about largely the question of the public sphere, but are you using a particular theorist?
Yeah, when people say the public sphere, the name that generally emerges as kind of the core theorist associated with the concept is Jürgen Habermas, who's a German theorist. He was, or actually still is, he's still alive, even though I kind of find it difficult to believe myself, a member of the Frankfurt School for Critical Theory. So he was kind of having Adorno and Horkheimer as his supervisors, but is very much one of the kind of younger generation of that school, and wrote a kind of seminal text, or the seminal text, on the public sphere as his postdoctoral dissertation, which is something that you have to do in the German education system in order to be admitted to being a professor, essentially. So he wrote that that text on the public sphere, which is called The Structural Transformation of the Public Sphere, as his dissertation.
Right. I mean,
when was that text published?
That text was published in 1962 in German, and then 1989 in English.
Oh, it took some time for it to be translated.
Yeah, there was quite a big lag. So it got a pretty strong reception in its original publication in German. And I think that kind of ongoing reception, and both positive and also critical reception, was what led to it being translated into English.
I wanted to make a little quip about living thinkers, just because, I mean, they're annoying in that they can actually change their ideas. And I wonder if he's, either repudiated parts of it, rethought the text and such.
Yeah, in terms of his kind of progression of the concept from that text and then later on, his kind of idea of where the basis of democracy lies changes over time. But he's maybe less annoying, although more annoying for me, in that he has stayed very much kind of true to the Frankfurt critical theory model, in that the media are terrible and they're corrupting us all, and he hates the internet and hates television and hates everything, and thinks that we should just be reading kind of high culture texts. Mass culture, popular culture is useless. So he really hasn't budged from that position at all. So he hasn't changed much, but that in itself is kind of annoying to me.
Can you blame him? You can see where my sympathies lie. But yeah, okay, so how do we begin to understand the concept of the public sphere? Did he coin the phrase, or does it come from somewhere else?
The phrase has been around kind of before Habermas, so it's always been this idea of there being a public space where people can have kind of democratic deliberation and democratic discussion is not really a new idea. It's something that's been around since kind of Greek democracy, people coming together in public to discuss things. And it's kind of always been linked to democracy through all these different conceptions, but Habermas is really the one who's kind of credited with nailing it down and discussing it in a very specific way, in a way that kind of gives us a more normative model that can be used better to kind of approach or critique democracy through.
Was he responding to a particular problem or issue in the discourse of that time?
Yes, he's responding to several things, I guess, although kind of responding to them after they've happened in many respects. It's basically a critique of advanced capitalism and of the model of information and communication and kind of democratic deliberation that has arisen in advanced capitalism. So he's looking at the transition from kind of European feudal societies in England and France and Germany, looking at the revolutions and the kind of rise of constitutionalism, the rise of democracy rather than feudalism, and then what he sees is kind of the corruption of that sort of heyday of democracy by advanced capitalism, and particularly by the modern media.
So in what way did Habermas believe that capitalism corrupted democracy in its more, I guess, pure form?
Okay. The The public sphere, the bourgeois public sphere, which is what he's kind of essentializing or idealizing in looking at those particular contexts of England, Germany, and France. Obviously, it's a bourgeois public sphere, so we're talking about bourgeois people being involved in it, people who are propertied, people who are educated. This kind of came about as part of the rise of capitalism, the move from feudalism into capitalism, partially because of the need for kind of better communicative infrastructures to allow for kind of long-distance trade and long-distance capitalism. So that turned into sort of the commodification of information, the rise of the press, the rise of people writing letters, getting together in kind of literary societies, all these kinds of things. So this is where kind of this concept of the first public sphere or the bourgeois public sphere emerges from. But obviously there's a problem there. If we're talking about democracy and we're just talking about the propertied, educated classes, there's a massive issue. The public sphere is kind of predicated on this concept that anybody should be allowed into it and that you leave your kind of private status or your private prestige, your private rank, who you are in your private life behind, and you come in and it's the force of the better argument that prevails rather than who you are, what authority you have, how rich you are, all of those kind of things. So there's a tension inherent in the bourgeois public sphere. The way that it was kind of explained away, or the way that Habermas talks about it being explained away, is that if we think about kind of free market capitalism, it basically says that anyone can be educated, anyone can be propertied, therefore anyone can participate in democracy. That's, I mean, from my perspective and from many kind of critical theorists' perspectives, that's obviously very ideological. It's not true. Kind of this concept of social mobility is a lie. It's false in many instances. That's kind of one of the critiques of capitalism that emerges from it.
I wonder if we could sort of just backtrack a little, because I think we kind of raced ahead into the critique of it without getting into the meat of his concept. And also, I think in some ways, some of the terms that need to be sort of fleshed out a little, because, you know, often within certain circles, the notion of the bourgeoisie is very kind of a negative, kind of term. And what actually one has to do is to kind of locate the bourgeoisie as a class that's emergent out, as you said, you know, from feudalism.
Yeah.
And its release, as Marx kind of like noted very famously, released all these productive energies.
Mm.
And so included the very basis for the creation of a democracy. So democracy in some ways needed that class,
yep,
to emerge in the first place. And I think of a very interesting consequence, and this is in music, which is that the emergence of a public sphere and people attending musical performances of a certain sort actually transformed musical instruments. Mm-hmm. You went from, you know, like the harpsichord and its limited amplification to pianos, which actually allowed for greater appreciation. It's very interesting,
wow,
complex.
I didn't know that. That is fascinating.
Yeah, you know, relationships that were developing throughout this part of the world in the creation of the bourgeois class. And the contradictions between its sort of normative values and the reality of class society is something that I guess was inside the dynamics of that, but shouldn't be a basis for rejecting bourgeois democracy and some of its forms.
But I think Habermas notes that, it seems like from what you explained, he knows the complexity of it, right?
Yeah.
He notes that on one hand, the advancement of capital definitely opened up spaces for discourse, but there was still nonetheless this ideologizing narrative that sees that this discourse is not problematic,
yeah,
that it's all inclusive, that everybody can access it one day if they work hard enough. I think what he wants to do is dispel that myth. At least that's what I sense from your brief account,
yeah,
of his critique.
Yeah.
Yeah. So of course, capitalism is much better than feudalism, but it's still kind of wrapped in this ideological shell that I think he wants to undo.
But yep. Okay, so before he gets into that critique, how does he begin to kind of explain what can adequately mean by the public sphere? I mean, is there a definition or is there some sort of parameters?
Yeah, certainly. If we kind of, basically what he's trying to do, and again, this is skipping ahead, but I think it makes sense to do so here. Once he kind of goes through this critique and various other critiques, which I'm sure we'll get into sort of in due time, basically the intent of looking at this historically specific context or contexts is to try and liberate an ideal from those contexts. So the ideal of the public sphere is essentially a space between the private sphere and the state. So the private sphere being kind of the domestic sphere of the home. And obviously that probably gives an indication that there's a whole raft of gender kind of critiques that can be brought in there. A space between those two areas where people come together, they leave behind their private identity, they're free from any kind of control from the state. They come together as equals. They deliberate with one another, they discuss things with one another. The force of the better argument prevails. And people ideally come to a consensus and then convey that consensus to the state. So it's a mechanism for transmitting public opinion that is created through rational critical debate to the state.
But this is idealized, you said. And you say something quite interesting at the start of that description. You say he tries to wrench the ideal from the reality.
Yes.
Is that what you said? And why is that? I mean, what is it about Habermas's training that allows him to think of this as a productive way of going about, you know, the creation of knowledge?
That's a good question. The Frankfurt School is essentially a very multidisciplinary school, perhaps somewhat kind of, I guess maybe not so much before its time, because I guess it's drawing from that kind of Renaissance tradition where people know a little bit about a lot of different things and meld those ideas together. But it's drawing on a lot of different threads. So there's sociology, there's constitutional history, constitutional law, political science, various different perspectives, obviously also history. And I think basically, I'm not sure whether it's so much to do with his training, because the other thing, if you look at the Frankfurt School, is they're actually very pessimistic. It's kind of like everything is ruined, nothing is ever going to be any good, democracy will never be realised, we're all going to hell. I mean, you can kind of understand it if you look at when they were operating in terms of them being Jewish in Germany, ending up getting persecuted. But Habermas is different from them, and maybe it's a generational thing, I don't know, in that he tries to get beyond that. Not necessarily very successfully, and a lot of the critique is kind of based on whether he did it very successfully or not, but he's wanting to find something transcendental, basically. In this first book, the one that we've been talking about, he kind of is trying to locate something within institutions that can rescue democracy or that can make democracy flourish. He later goes on to look for it elsewhere, but he is looking for something kind of transcendental or essential that can support democracy.
I don't know if this is jumping ahead or, but I'm just going to try to weave it with what you just described there. Is this transcendental idea of democracy informed by some idea of a post-capitalist future or a post-capitalist circumstance or something like that?
In the structural transformation of the public sphere, like I said, he's kind of trying to look within institutions to see whether institutions can be transformed in some way. Basically, his conclusions after he's kind of ripped apart the mass media for their role in the what he calls the refeudalization of the public sphere. So we've gone from a feudal society to a bourgeois society to a kind of neo-feudalism. He then talks about his kind of hope for the mass media to be the tools of kind of democratic revolution, I guess, but doesn't talk about it very convincingly, and kind of also at the same time kind of seems to understand that the mass media have become pretty inextricably interwoven with capitalism and with money and with all those different things. So he goes on in his later work to look for a linguistic basis to this kind of transcendental idea. He thinks that within rational critical debate, so this idea of kind of having a very, very rational, civil, critical, again going back to this idea of the force of the better argument, within this form of speech, that's where the seed of democracy lies.
So it's more Kantian than Marxist. It's transcendental in that sense, yep. A Kantian where you form moral principles out of like universal consensus. Yeah. Yeah.
Great. We're going to come back with the development of Habermas's ideas around the public sphere shortly. You were listening to Tessa Horton from the University of Nottingham. I'm Fuad Rahman, and myself, Sharad Kutin. You're listening to Night School on BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, welcome back to Night School. I'm Sharad Kutin with Amar Fuad Rahmat and our guest, Tessa Horton from the University of Nottingham. She's an assistant professor in media and communications, and she's telling us a little bit about the work of Jürgen Habermas and the idea of the public sphere. It started off with trying to locate this ideal for kind of the foundations of a democracy within the public sphere. Mm-hmm. And then he'd moved away towards language.
No, he's not really moved. He's still talking about the public sphere, so still envisaging the sphere. But he basically sees the kind of core truth or the core democratic value of it. He goes from trying to look for that in institutions, such as the mass media, such as in kind of state-enabled institutions, to basically deciding that that's not going to happen, we may as well forget it, and therefore moves to looking for that kind of kernel of democracy in what he calls communicative action, a theory of communicative action.
But that's a separate book than the first one you mentioned.
Several separate books. Yeah. Yeah. He doesn't really do short form writing.
That's when his discourse ethics period, right? That's when he does that.
Okay, yeah. But what's important is that it's the same problematic. He's still trying to resolve the same problem, as it were, right? What is it that we need to know about the way in which he puts together the notion of the public sphere in the first place for us to better understand what he's dealing with?
I guess the core concept is something that we already touched on, is this kind of specific historical period that he's looking at, the move from feudalism to democracies in Europe, and particularly in those three countries, in England, France and Germany. The other thing that is important to look at is also the kind of next step in that evolution. So once we move into a kind of the kind of post-feudalism, where it's moving into constitutional democracies, obviously as part of that, it's kind of we've gone from kind of feudal control to seeing kind of the bourgeois strata of society as being the dominant part of society or the kind of important part of society. And what you said before about looking back at that period and recognising that bourgeois is not necessarily a dirty word, you know, like if you look in that particular context, it represents an evolution and a positive shift in terms of the way that society functions. But the next step in that, with the kind of expansion of the public sphere. So this is kind of linking back to his discussion of the mass media, so the rise of the mass media, the increasing popularisation of the mass media, increasing reading ability, people engaging more in kind of public discourse, led to an opening up of the public sphere. Then another tension comes in. So if we think about people like Mill and de Tocqueville talking about the tyranny of the majority, all of a sudden you don't have a uniform public sphere full of kind of relatively equally educated, relatively equally rich bourgeois people. You have a very diverse different stratas of society coming together, and people don't like it. People don't like inequality. So that brought about a whole lot of tensions within the public sphere, and then these lower classes in society kind of realizing that this myth of kind of free marketism, the fact that they're not necessarily going to be able to become rich and educated, started appealing to the state for help. So this leads to a whole raft of things kind of based on the dissolution or the evaporation of a solid boundary between public and private, which is one of the kind of core things that allows the concept of the public sphere to exist.
And what is the mechanism precisely for that dissolution?
The entry of different strata of society staking their claims to the democratic process. Whereas prior to capitalism, the realm of free discourse was only accessible to the privileged class, and the slaves and the women and the dispossessed were kept in the private sphere, where they were just supposed to produce kids or just do housework.
Yeah.
But then when you know capitalism revolutionized society, the marginalized could now participate in the public sphere, and it scared the privileged class.
Pretty much.
And that was where the state suddenly got involved and became, for many people, impartial player in that, and partial player in that, and it disrupts the whole ideal of discourse that Habermas wanted.
Yeah. Okay, so the idea here of a private sphere is not about necessarily about private concerns, but it's about the classes sort of that were part of the private sphere of the bourgeois world now coming to its own and having some sort of subjecthood. Is that what does it mean?
Yeah, there are,
because
there are
you still have the domestic, right? I mean, domestic doesn't disappear, does it?
No, but there are a whole lot of kind of ways of understanding that public-private divide, and linking the domestic with the private is certainly one very, very strong way of looking at that. The other ways beyond what Fuad has said in terms of the dissolution of that divide is that with these weaker classes starting to appeal more to the state, the state starts to engage in things like social welfare, in things like social engineering, are trying to fix issues in society. So if you think about social engineering, it's the state trying to get involved in people's private lives. If you think about social welfare, it's the state supporting people in their kind of private identity. And we think about those things, and I think it's right to think about those things as good things. They need to happen if we're going to keep kind of continuing with a capitalist paradigm where social mobility is actually kind of very difficult, then the state needs to, in my opinion, be involved in those kind of things. But it does break down that differentiation between public and private. So Habermas talks about the state becoming societalized and society becoming statified. So it's that kind of merging of society and the state, which means that the public sphere is not this kind of critical independent space anymore. There's all this flux and kind of intermingling between the two spheres, not in the kind of rational, critical way that he idealizes as being essential to democracy.
And he locates this in historical terms. So he can sort of say, well, post-war, this is what we see happening. And where does he place this moment of this shift happening?
Yeah, he kind of places, I guess, this moment of the what he calls the fall or the refeudalization of the public sphere pretty much, I think, in the 20th century, essentially. Kind of throughout the 20th century.
And that gives rise to all kinds of political movements from the fascists to the communists, all of which in some ways have, I guess, just listening to what you're saying, have a similar character. They all involve the state somehow. You know, the fascist state is creating a mass society, right? Mm-hmm. Where there's very little intermediate institutions. There's the feudal, you know, the fascist leader and the mass of followers. But the state is still paternalistic. And whereas in the communist model, you have that a very similar kind of ideal of the state as a kind of paternal force supporting the mass of society.
Yeah, very much so. So there's that, which is part of his critique, and also the other part of the critique, which is located very strongly within the rise of the mass media, and we see that with the rise of things like propaganda and public relations, which emerged very strongly after World War I, that politics becomes not a place where people have critical rational debate, where they deliberate things, where they discuss things, where the force of the better argument emerges. It becomes something that's played out through the media. People with the most money and the most power have the most access to the media. So the public sphere, he talks about it becoming a pseudo-public, basically. It's a place in which public prestige is displayed rather than debate is carried out.
You mentioned earlier that there's a strong strand of pessimism underlying his theorizing. I wonder if it's what's informing his idealizing of the public sphere for this democratic discourse to happen is just really a negation of the corrupt forms democracy has taken in capitalism. Or is there more? Does he prescribe a way to get to that ideal?
To get to kind of an idealistic capitalist democracy?
Or just democracy in general, public sphere, yeah.
In the first book, the one that we're kind of concentrating on most strongly, the structural transformation of the public sphere, he thinks basically that there is a chance that the mass media can be democratised. So there are links made here very often with public service broadcasting. this is kind of in the pre-internet kind of media studies discipline, there's a lot of talk about public broadcasting as being the way in which the public sphere can be attained again, basically, and this kind of links in with things, I guess, like Benedict Anderson's imagined community, that everyone can come together through public broadcasting and we can have a mediated public sphere that isn't just kind of in the sway of money and power. But then later he goes on to basically give up on this. What we see emerging in kind of more contemporary discussions of the public sphere, the thing that I guess has probably quite obviously replaced public broadcasting is the internet, and that maybe the internet is a place where we can locate the public sphere. But Habermas hates the internet, so...
No, I would actually disagree. I don't think it... To me, Habermas is actually kind of a optimist. I mean, he's constantly looking for that opportunity to redeem the ideals of democracy and to find a way. I mean, the whole idea of communicative rationality, you know, this rather kind of like a restatement of an Enlightenment project of reason being able to triumph is actually extraordinarily optimistic in the face of, you know, the hideous and grotesque politics of the 20th century.
Yeah.
You think that people would give up by in the 60s, you know, it would be, you know, free love and anything but politics as a way of redeeming society, right?
Yeah. So it's actually interesting that you say that, because he submitted his dissertation, the first book, originally to the Frankfurt School, and they rejected it. And some people argue that they rejected it purely because it wasn't pessimistic and critical enough for them.
You've said several times that he's very critical of, I guess, new media. I mean, in his context, you know, he was new and he's still not very enthused about the internet. So why?
I mean, I honestly think that it's very generational. I mean, he's really old now. This is what I said before. I'm actually quite amazed that he's still alive, because he is very old.
Is his 80s?
Probably 90s by now, I think. He's an old cranky guy, basically, as you'd probably expect from someone coming from...
Old cranky optimist.
Maybe optimist. So I think that there is some generational disengagement there, but it's also founded on a lot of those kind of quite common critiques of what the internet is like, that it's kind of reduced to 140 characters, then you can't have rational critical debate in 140 characters. And
well, that's Twitter.
Yeah, I know, but kind of this kind of stupidity of the internet, where it's very vacuous.
Yeah, but you know, and you know, just last week we were talking about precisely this, and about in many ways the new, you know, more interactive, horizontal, democratic, you know, potentially revolutionary forms are constantly being recoded for basically the commodification of, you know, retail space on the net, and you know, and basically, you know, if it's refeudalization, it's something else that's going on. We're not actually making that leap forward. We seem to be finding new interesting forms, but they seem to be doing the same thing.
Yeah.
You know, and I for that reason, you can imagine, I mean, you could sympathize with his pessimism, you know, but pessimism in a kind of, you know, in that old Gramscian sense, you know, kind of a pessimism of the intellect, but a kind of optimism in some ways, right? That there is this idea that you can get somewhere. It's just a question of when and how. And
It's it's the classic Marxist impulse in him, I think, to see the some positive and the negatives as well. I have a question that might be a bit critical, but I think it's about time. Can I do the critique part?
Yes.
All right. No, well, just from listening, I haven't spent much time with Habermas. Maybe some couple of essays and some reader or whatever. But it seems like he's functioning on a very abstract ideal of democracy.
Yeah.
That never existed and might never exist in the future. In a sense that his theory of the participant of discourse is just so... It's again an abstraction.
Yeah.
It's an idealized form.
Yeah, but you know, abstractions have their use, right? So you think of the work of Max Weber, the idea of ideal forms as a way of, it's a kind of heuristic device. It's a tool to understand the world better. It's not about saying this, that somehow the world has to conform to the ideal, but by having that horizon, then you can somehow work against it towards something. And if you have a more programmatic mode of thinking, thinking that you might be using this as some sort of checklist and what would actually be something you want to achieve, or that you are actually on the road to some achievement, right?
Yeah, I don't think the problem is abstraction per se. Is abstraction for what, right? If it's a heuristic model or something on the basis on which you can critique something, I think it makes sense. But if it's a state to aspire to, then it becomes transcendental. It becomes almost quasi-religious in a way. And that's, I think that's... So it's the question of how do we best use our idealized form? So, I mean...
Tessa, you, I know, are quite critical of Habermas. Yeah. Maybe it's time for you to channel that to critique. You can speak now.
Okay. Been pretending I like him the whole time. No, I mean, that's not true. I do like Habermas. And a lot of the very strong critiques, which are actually what I kind of... I guess intellectually align myself much more with, as the kind of feminist, radical, kind of postmodernist kind of critiques. A lot of them still kind of in the first few sentences, and again in the last few sentences, will say how you can't get away from Habermas. He's incredibly important, and maybe the importance isn't necessarily in his text, it's in what his text catalyzes, which is all this kind of critique and this kind of continued thinking about how we might try and define what an ideal democracy is. Because we can kind of talk about how great democracy is and how much we want it or we like, but if we don't know what it is, how can we try and get it, you know? So this, a lot of the kind of feminist critiques focus, and a lot of the critiques overall, in fact, focus on the kind of historical specificity, and that he's talking about the bourgeois public sphere, and sure, he's talking about how he recognises that people were excluded from it, but he doesn't talk about the fact that there were other public spheres functioning at the same time. There were proletarian public spheres, there were feminist or kind of female public spheres at that time as well, and he doesn't think about them. He doesn't look at them to try and find any kind of transcendental ideal. And that's not to say that his ideal is necessarily inherently wrong, if we're coming from this kind of historically kind of critical perspective, just that he should have looked more widely. And there's a whole lot of kind of critique based on that kind of historical specificity. A lot of the other critique, and this is engaging with his later kind of theory of communicative action, in that rational critical debate is the best way to achieve democracy, to achieve the public sphere, and that we should be looking for consensus. A lot of that critique is obviously, it's more kind of theoretically focused, and it's basically talking about things like the fact that access to rational critical debate isn't equal. We can't just say, oh, well, let's just forget about those economic issues and differences in genders, differences in ethnicities, differences in all that kind of stuff, because rational critical debate is the domain of the educated rich white man. Yeah, you can't just kind of go, oh, well, it's okay, we'll look for it in language that's transcendental. Language can be ideological too, and access to language is ideological as well. And again, with talking about consensus, this idea that the force of the better argument will prevail doesn't really pan out. I mean, democracy is founded on difference. If we arrive at a consensus, it means that everyone's become the same, essentially. That's not only kind of extremely unlikely in terms of reality, it completely kind of subjugates or nullifies democracy. So a lot of the later critique is talking about how we can accommodate difference, how consensus shouldn't be the aim, but kind of peaceful engagement with difference should be the aim.
That's
interesting.
Just kind of lastly, in terms of where somebody might go for an exposition of his work, beyond his work itself, and a kind of critique of it, that's fair to the ideas that Habermas had, where would you go? What would you suggest?
I should have brought a list with me to remember the exact titles.
We can put them up on our Facebook page.
Okay, that would be great. There's a really good reader that's edited by Craig Calhoun, which contains... Habermas doesn't do a huge deal of short-form writing, which I said before. It's kind of these massive, chunky tomes that have been translated from German and are very Germanic in the way that they're presented, and they're not necessarily the most accessible works. But that edition has, or edited volume, has got a short form work by him, and it's got a lot of different critiques and discussions of his work. The introduction is a really good kind of introduction to his work overall, and it also contains the kind of seminal, for me, the kind of seminal critique of Habermas, which is by Nancy Fraser, which talks about the post-structuralist public sphere and identifies a lot of really important critiques that kind of lead the theoretical tradition that I prefer to engage with.
Well, it's wonderful. Well, that's been stuff. A really time has just whizzed past. You feel? You could engage with Tessa more extensively on our Facebook page. That's BFM Night School. Yep. You can also write to her via us at BFM nightschool@gmail.com.
Your tweet, we assume.
I do when I have time. At Tidgeh. So Tidgeh.
I'm at Sharad Kutin. Fuad has not joined the Twitter revolution because he might be a pessimist.
Maybe he's friends with Habermas.
I might just read up more Habermas after this. Yeah,
that's the idea. So thank you so much. You've been listening to Tessa Horton. Tessa is an assistant professor in media and communications at Nottingham University, Malaysia. You were also listening to Ahmad Fuad Rahmat. I'm Sharad Kutin. This is Night School on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.